Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan Compass came from the...
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I have the honor of interviewing Chelsea Weidman. She is a mom of two and has been married for 11 years, has a bachelor's degree from BYU in English Language and Literature, and has just finished her certification in American Ballet Theater's Natural Training Curriculum, which sounds really interesting and neat. She's been teaching ballet for 15 years and works as a guest artist with local dance companies. Welcome, Chelsea, to the program.
Hi. It sounds weird to hear my bio said out loud.
Well, thank you for being with us today. We are we're going to talk about a pretty sensitive topic, which is that of sexual assault. And Chelsea has been very open and willing to come and talk about such a difficult thing that happened in her life and in many people's lives. And so I just want to throw out there at the very beginning that some of the information we share might be triggering to those listening. And so to just be aware of that. And she has stated that she will be open and frank about what happened to her. So I just want to throw that out there for anybody who maybe decides this isn't a good time in their life to listen to something like this. So with that being said, is there anything that you'd like to add to that introduction as far as content that we'll be discussing?
No, if this isn't something that someone wants to listen to, there's no shame in that. It's hard. It's hard to talk about and it's hard to hear. And if that's just not something you can do, then that's okay.
Yeah. Cause we're all people who have struggled with sexual assault in their life are just on all different parts of the journey. Right. And so,
yeah.
Okay, great. Well, so let's start a little bit with just tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of your history and how you come to be a Mormon and things of that nature.
Okay. Well, I was raised in the church, was baptized when I was 8. My dad's family have been members for ever. my mom's family, her parents were inactive. My grandmother went to the temple in her when she was 80. And then she was sealed to my grandfather a year after he died. And we all, well, those of us that are a little bit more lighthearted joke that he's going to come back and haunt us. I don't think he was happy about that. I'm actually in Provo. I was born in Provo. I was raised here. I moved away for a little bit and then managed to come back, which I never thought I would do. So I kind of feel like if we're going to talk about Mormon culture, boy, howdy, I live in it.
You're in the heart of it.
Yes, which, you know, there are pros and cons.
Sure. Okay. All right. So, yeah, definitely a part of your growing up then. And it sounds like your family was an active family and whatever terminology we use to describe that. And obviously you chose to go to a church school and it was a big part of your life.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, well, let's get into then kind of why we're here today, and just I'm just going to kind of turn the time over to you to kind of just share your story with us as far as sexuality when it comes to assault in that nature, as far as being able to talk about what happened to you.
Okay, well. So it happened at church, and one Sunday, I got dropped off at nursery, and I had a favorite nursery leader, and he was, the first time that I ever felt really beautiful and special to somebody outside of my family was with this nursery leader, and I have always had this very fond memory of him. We did self-portraits, the kids lay on butcher paper and the grown-ups trace them. And then the the kids color them in, and I had been wearing one of my favorite outfits, and it had little pinstripes on it. And I just remember him spending so much time with me that day, helping me get every single little pinstripe in and all the buttons. And I remember feeling just so special that he would be as interested in me as I was. So I had this relationship with him. And
so you're pretty young. I mean, you're a nursery, yeah. So you're what, like a year and a half old, or
no? This was like three and a half,
3 years old.
I would have been a sunbeam, like very shortly.
Okay, so definitely in a time frame where you can still remember.
Right. Yeah. So I went to nursery, and he was there, and at some point during the day, the two of us left the room. And I don't remember, you know, I probably wanted a drink or something like that. I don't know. And we went into an empty classroom, and he lifted me up onto the table, you know, because it's a Mormon classroom. There's a table in every room. And he lifted up my skirt, and he pulled off my underwear, and he put his left hand on my chest to hold me down. And he said, "Remember, we're in the church. We have to be very reverent." And then he raped me. And I didn't call out. I didn't scream. I was in a building full of people. And I didn't let anybody know that I was there. Because I trusted him. And he had said, "We are in the church. We need to be reverent." And then when he was finished, he helped me get dressed again, and we went back into the nursery room and went on with the day like nothing happened. And I do remember telling a couple of adults, but their response was that I shared some of that responsibility, that I essentially, it was what, you know, what did you do to make him think that would be okay? Which I think is, I have been sexually assaulted other times in my life, which sometimes makes me think that there is something wrong with me, that I just can't seem to avoid this. But I think it's horrible to say to a woman, a grown woman, "What did you do to make him think you wanted it?" But I think it is a million times worse to say it to a kid, because there's no way that a kid wants that. There's no way that a kid understands that they can say something about it. So anyway, sorry, my phone buzzed. I didn't realize it was on the desk. I told a couple of people, and the response was not supportive. So I never talked about it again until about 30 years later. I never even really believed in like repressed memories until it happened to me. But I did not think about it. Every memory I've had of this man for years and years and years was the happy one, where he, you know, took all of this time to make me feel special. And for a very, very long time, I wouldn't even touch the memory of the bad things that he did. So that is the short version of my story.
Okay. So there's a lot packed in there, and obviously I can hear the emotion in your voice. So, you know, even these many years later, it's difficult to talk about, as it should be. So I guess my first questions have to do with, you say that you shared this information with other people in your life. Are you talking about shortly after, like when you're still 3 to 4 years old, somewhere around there?
Yeah.
And who happened to be these people? Was it people in your family or leaders or?
It was adults in my family. And I remember very clearly, the shame in their eyes. And as a kid, I thought that they were ashamed of me and that that was my fault. And now as I look back on it, I'm starting to think that that shame might have been that moment of realizing they weren't going to do anything about it. They weren't ready to confront that. But I don't know. I have not spoken with them about it as an adult because it was bad enough to feel blame and shame the first time. I don't want to do it again.
So how does your 3-year-old self even find language to share what happened? You know, I mean, I'm guessing you didn't know the word rape or
no.
How did you even start talking about this in a child's language?
Well, I've always been a talker. So I had a better grasp on language than probably an average 3-year-old. I said my first 2-word phrase at 9 months and it just kind of went from there. So I had a lot of words at my disposal, but, you know, I said that he put his fingers inside of me and then I got a funny feeling and that I kind of liked it, but I didn't like it. And I didn't know, I was really scared.
So that's the language you were using with adults.
Yeah. Which I feel is adequately descriptive, but they didn't do anything.
So, because this is, now we're getting into a whole different type of piece of this is the different reactions victims get when they tell, right? And so some family members or adults in their lives react in what we would call appropriate ways, and some obviously don't. What are your thoughts about why this went so awry in the sense of nobody coming to your side or to your rescue when it came to this pretty devastating thing? I mean, you know, imagining my 3-year-old coming and saying something like this, I mean, I'm sure all of us can imagine that. What would our reaction be, you know? So what was taking place in the family dynamics or in the cultural dynamics that played into choosing to ignore this plea from a 3-year-old?
My family was under a lot of stress that year. My dad was working really hard at work because, you know, he was a young professional and trying to get established and trying to provide for his family. And he was fortunate enough to have a job that he loved and wanted to be successful at. And I'm the oldest. My younger brother had recently been born, and within a week of his birth, he had contracted spinal meningitis and gone back into the NICU. And then even when he came home, you know, there were years of trying to figure out the extent of any potential brain damage. So that colored a lot of my preschool, like 3 and 4 and 5-year-old memories. And then on top of that, my dad was called into a bishopric for the first time at about that time. And so, you know, there was a lot going on, and I am choosing to believe that the people that I told just kind of felt like, okay, I can't do one more thing, and this is the most recent, so I'm not picking it up. And I also really feel like there might have been, I mean, there has always been a lot of pressure that I have felt from my family, whether it was intentional or not. I've always felt a lot of pressure to just make it look okay. You know, we're doing all of the things that we're supposed to. So just make it look okay. Don't tell anybody. Oh, also my mom had, I hope my mom doesn't listen to this. She will not be happy that I say this, but my mom had pretty significant postpartum depression at this time. So, you know, everybody was just maxed out, and there was a lot of pressure to, you know, we're this good little Mormon family. We got to look the part, and what happened to me does not look the part at all. So, I don't actually know, because like I said, I have not brought it up as an adult, and I don't plan to.
Right. So, yeah. So a lot of these things, I mean, you're choosing to come on and do this program with me at a time when things are still being processed, you know, like you're still in this journey, you know, and yeah. I'm not sure that a journey of trauma ever ends necessarily, but we go through different phases of it. Right. And different aspects of it. So, okay, so there was a lot of stressors going on in your family, and there was this kind of maybe cultural pressure and even familial pressure to give the persona that things are good and things are being held together. And even you mentioning that your mom might have a hard time listening to the idea that she had postpartum depression. There's still some maybe shame in that or something, where that's a pretty common diagnosis, right? Like that's not something she should feel badly about.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. When I had my first kid, you know, and I also get postpartum depression. You know, I told that to my mom, and she said, "Oh yes, you know, when I had your brother, I went to see a psychiatrist at BYU. It was a friend from the ward. And she said, I need Prozac." And he had said, no. Every mother goes through this. It's very normal. And my mom had said, no, these are the things that I'm thinking. And he said, oh yes, you do need Prozac. And I think the difference between, you know, 1983 and then when I had my first in 2005, just the difference there is huge, because nobody said, oh no, this is normal. Everybody said, yes, take something. Let's get this better.
Right. There's still a lot of, there's still a lot of stigma today. And of course, like you're saying, back in the 1980s, that stigma would have been even more acute for your mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned this term repressed memories, which is a really hot topic, right? As far as controversial topic. And I think that there's the reason why that is because there was a time in not our, you know, not too distant past where, there was a lot of, psychologists who would ask very leading questions, and, you know, there were, you know, kind of like a flurry of activity around repressed memories, right? Where a lot of people were incarcerated, and, you know, whether or not that was an appropriate reaction, you know, that's all very much still a problem in our history. So, and at the same time, we know that through trauma studies that, you know, one of the ways that we handle trauma as far as coping is to, you know, not think about, to distract ourselves from painful memories, right? And to not necessarily live with them every day of our lives. And we do that through a lot of different ways. Healthy ways, like exercise, or, you know, healthy distractions, and unhealthy ways like alcoholism and cutting, or, you know, there's just a whole slew of things that people do to cope with feelings and things that have happened that are traumatic. So can you share with me a little bit of your journey as to how you came to think of these memories again, and what your journey has been in that regard, and how did you come to start remembering these things again?
Yeah, I'm happy to say it. I feel like it's not going to lend any legitimacy to my story, because it's just kind of weird, but that's okay. I mean, I'm not doing this so that anybody, you know, I'm not looking for legitimacy. I'm just ready to be honest, I guess. But, so I've been working with a therapist that I really like. And he had asked me a couple of times. He said, did anybody hurt, you know, well, what he had said was, you have some real anger about church. Did anybody hurt you there? And I said, no. And he's like, okay. And we just moved on. And I've been working with him for a while, and, you know, and I didn't feel like that was any kind of pressure or anything. Just, I do have a lot of anger when I think about church and the church culture. And you know, I kind of feel like as a therapist, his job was to say, hey, do you want to talk about this? And when I said no, he dropped it completely and he never brought it up again. And we talked about other things. And then,
that's a legitimate question to ask. I mean, I have questions like that on my intake form. Have you ever been sexually abused, right? Or have you ever been hurt in some way, right? And so that's a question that's different from leading and continuing to pressure people into a certain thought process. Is that fair
to
say?
Yeah. Like it was, you know, there was no leading. It was just an honest question. And then, you know, we continued to work and I've been working with a therapist for so long. Part of me thinks this is embarrassing. And part of me thinks, whatever, just let it be. So anyway, we kind of got to a place where, I actually am not an anxious person. I'd never had an anxiety attack before, but I was getting very, very anxious and I was feeling like I was choking on something and I couldn't say something. And so my therapist was like, well, will you go see a friend of mine? And I was like, well, it depends on who your friend is. He was like, okay, that's fair enough. He's like, will you go see a friend of mine? She's a massage therapist and she does body work as well. And I was like, well, yeah, I'm a ballerina. I can always use a good massage and we'll just see where this goes. And so I went to see her in addition to my therapy sessions. And I had just kind of assumed, well, you know, I've been dancing for so many years. I just have these permanent knots. And she's like, well, let's work on those. And so she started to work on these really old, old knots. And as the knot released, I actually gasped and she stopped and said, are you okay? And I just kind of laid there and shook for a little bit because suddenly it was like I was back. You know, I wasn't looking on from the outside. I was looking through my own eyes and I remembered what he was wearing and exactly what he looked like and where the window was in the room and what time of day it was. And I remembered, I just, everything was there. And that's when I was able to start talking about it. And even then I tend to be more of a writer than a talker. And so I have emailed my therapist so many times. I can't believe he hasn't blocked me yet, but these things would come out and I would start writing them. And so that's how I remembered. And it's actually been really interesting. You know, I'm married. There's a certain degree of intimacy that comes with that. And now, you know, whenever I have intercourse with my husband, who is extremely respectful of my limits and so gentle and so willing to let me be completely in charge of the experience. And even in the safest way that I can construct to have these kinds of intimate relationships with people, you know, we finish and I feel really, you know, it feels really good and it's really pleasant. And then about 20 minutes later, I will get just these stabbing, stabbing, stabbing pains where it hurt the first time and where I had that muscle knot for years and years and years. I would like to be able to be intimate with my husband without having this come back, but I am not particularly hopeful that that will happen. I don't know if that answers. I don't even remember the question. So
that's okay.
Maybe we should move on.
how long ago did this experience happen with you having this massage and kind of having this release of energy? It sounds like where you were able to look at this piece of your life.
It has been almost 6 months.
So fairly recently.
Yeah. I tend to be an all or nothing person. And so I was like, all right, well, let's go.
Yeah. Well, and not that it's necessarily my place to say this, but I think that that's fairly recent to even make an assumption as what you're making, you know, that this might not be something that you ever experienced differently with your spouse. I think it's pretty early in the healing process. I would have hope that that would be different. And, you know, and I think that, I mean, part of how I work with trauma victims and sexual assault is that if you're lucky enough to have a spouse who, like you're saying, is comfortable with limits and safety and is very aware of, you know, just making that a safe place for you, then it's often through some of our physical and intimate experiences that that healing continues. So even though you're having some negative repercussions, I'm not sure that that's not, you know, just like a knee surgery. Your knee hurts for a while after surgery, right?
I hope so.
Yeah. So I would be hopeful for that. Yeah, because this is very recent that this has all been kind of coming up for you. I think a lot of what you're saying rings true with so much of the research that's being done around trauma, which is, I think for a long time in the psychology field, you know, we've been trying to separate what's biological and what's psychological, right? And I think that is really being completely rethought in the last 10 to 15 years, that there's really no way to separate those things, that the things that happen to us psychologically have physical manifestations and symptoms attached to that, as do the physical things that happen to us then have psychological ramifications. So it's kind of like the chicken and the egg analogy. And that kind of makes sense. And it even kind of makes sense with our kind of Mormon upbringing, right? That our spiritual and physical and emotional aspects would all be kind of connected with one another. Is that fair to say?
You know, I've never really thought about it that way. It was so clearly true for me that, I mean, you know, I spent the first 24 hours just really not wanting to believe at all. And I was like, no, I don't believe in repressed memories. This is not a real thing. But, you know, I have the internet. So I started reading about it and I was like, okay, well that, you know, all right, maybe it's real. And then I was like, you know, I had to have reconstructive surgery on my vaginal opening in my early teens, which, you know, I was like, that, now that I'm thinking about it, that sounds strange. And so I researched, you know, it's like 2 a.m. and I'm online, which is always a good sign, but I started researching this particular surgery and the medical research is very confident. You know, there are two reasons that this happens. It is either something that you are born with that needs to be fixed, or it is a very telltale result of trauma. And the more recent publications that are out are talking about how, you know, if someone comes in, you know, this is something that should be appropriately looked at in pediatric checkups, because if it's fine 1 year and it's not the next, that's a really good indication that someone has hurt this child and someone needs to stand up for them. And so, you know, I have no way of knowing, you know, well, actually that's not true. I mean, if it had been a birth defect, then rape would not have been physically possible. But, you know, we're getting better at this, but you know, once I realized, okay, I physically have scars from this, then it was a lot easier for me. I felt like that took me out of the realm of crazy and into the realm of, well, I don't know. For some reason, it was just different for me. When it was a repressed memory, I felt like it, I don't know, but having physical evidence that it was real and it happened and it had to be fixed, just let me know that it was okay to admit that this was real and okay to remember all of this. And I wasn't making it up for attention and I wasn't making it up to try to shortcut any other kind of like emotional or psychological growth. It really happened and I really could start to be sad about it.
Yeah, so legitimizing it for yourself. I mean, like you said earlier, it's not your job to legitimize this for other people, but it was important to legitimize it for yourself.
Yeah.
And it's not uncommon from a lot of the different ways that people, you know, come into my office space with trauma experiences. You know, many will describe things like, you know, it wasn't until I went away to college that I woke up one morning and looked at myself and said, I've been sexually abused, you know, and I never really thought about that before. Or, you know, we'll have a dream or we'll have some type of, maybe even sexual experience with somebody and have sensations or feelings that they hadn't expected that, you know, kind of start helping them think through these things that happened earlier. So, this is not uncommon to have people, you know, kind of come to terms with something that happened, especially in early childhood, through these types of means. So then you talk about having other sexual assault happenings in your life. Are you comfortable moving into that, into those stories?
Sure. Yeah. So the next one was not too much longer. It was a year or two later. I had a cousin who that particular side of the family is I feel like it's big. I'm sure there are Mormons out there who are like, oh no, honey, that is a small family. But to me, it's a big family. I'm one of the youngest cousins. And anyway, I had this cousin who was probably about 4 years older than me. And when we would arrive at my grandparents' house, he would run over and trap me, like pin me against the wall or give me a bear hug or, you know, do whatever it took to make sure I couldn't get away and start French kissing me, you know, and I hated it and I would squirm and I would try to push him away. But, you know, I mean, the difference between a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old is significant. And you know, my aunts and uncles and parents and grandparents would be in the room and they would tell him to stop, but nobody would ever get up and make him stop. I feel like it happened so many times and then all of a sudden it just stopped. I don't know why. I'm not close to that cousin at all. I haven't seen him in over 10 years and that's fine. I'm still close with my other cousins. Until very recently, that was the earliest kind of, you know, violation that I remembered, and it was ongoing, and it was, now that I am a parent, you know, if someone did that to one of my kids, I guarantee I would pull them off. You know, if we were going into a situation where I knew they would be there, I would carry my child or go in first as a shield. I don't know. I would just handle it very differently. So that was the first. And then I went a long time where nothing happened. And then when I was a freshman at BYU, a guy that I had known from high school, you know, I mean, I grew up in Provo, and going to BYU felt a lot like high school part two that first year, because, you know, the group of friends, we all did the AP classes together, and then we all moved into the dorms too. And it was like, oh, I'm not meeting new people. A friend of mine, you know, we'd been friends for years, and we'd gone to a school dance together in high school, and I'd gone to his house plenty of times, and he'd come to my house. And he called me one afternoon. It was spring, and it was April, and BYU students don't get a spring break. And so I was really itching to get outside. He's like, hey, do you want to go for a ride up the canyon today with me? And I was like, yeah, I do. I'm going to skip class for the first time in my entire life, and let's go for a drive up the canyon. It's springtime. It's the end of the semester. This will be fun. Let's go. So I got in his truck, which I had been in many, many times before. And we went up a drive, you know, up Provo Canyon, and we were having this great conversation. We'd, you know, it was a friend that I would get with, you know, how sometimes the Mormon culture at BYU just gets, well, for me, it would get just a little bit oppressive. And this is a friend that I would hang out with and kind of vent a little bit, and we would swear and, go ahead and you can judge all you want. I don't care. You know, we were just having this really good conversation, and he parked the truck, not in a parking lot. He had gone kind of off onto a back road. He'd parked the truck and he turned it off, and I looked at him and he said, "What kind of panties are you wearing?" And I went, "Excuse me?" He's like, "Take off your pants. I want to see your panties." And I was like, "No." And I went to open the truck door and it was locked. And I went to unlock it, and I don't know how this doesn't make sense, but whatever. He had some kind of, he was like, "No, I've set the doors. You can't unlock them." And I really couldn't. I really could not unlock the door. I couldn't get over him to get to the other door. He was on top of me and he just kept saying, "Show me your panties." He was breathing very heavily, and I kept saying no. And I started to cry. And I don't know why, but he gave up and he said, "Okay, fine." And he got off of me and he drove me back to my dorm and he unlocked my door and I got out. And, you know, in on the spectrum of things that can happen, I feel like that one's not particularly bad. I kept all my clothes on. He didn't, you know, he gave up. At most, he laid on top of me and I was trapped in a car, which actually, when I say it out loud, sounds kind of awful. But I came back and I was really scared to say anything. I didn't tell anybody about what happened with my cousin, because who are you going to tell? They were all there. And then with this guy in college, I didn't tell anybody again, because all I could think was, it was my fault. If I hadn't skipped class, I would not have been there. If I had been doing what I was supposed to, this would not have happened. This was my fault. If my daughter or my sister said that to me, I would be all over that logic now and say, no, you can make as many mistakes as you want in the world. It is never your fault. That was the third time. And then the fourth time, was about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. We had bought our first home, and my oldest was in kindergarten, and I would walk her to the school, and I would just stop every day for a couple of minutes to talk to the crossing guard. He was this nice old grandpa. He seemed kind of lonely, and I was like, I've got nothing else to do. If this was my grandpa, I would want someone to say hi to him, right? Like, it's just not, you know, just a friendly thing, just a neighborly thing. And then he was gone for a few days and I didn't see him. And then he came back. I was like, "Oh, I've missed you." And he said he was sick. And I was like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I hope you're feeling better." And, you know, I would ask how his wife was doing. And he was like, "So, you know," cause he was right by the school. He was like, "Do you walk very far?" I was like, "Yeah, I walk about a half mile. I'm at the very boundary, you know," and just neighborly things. And in the process of building this relationship, you know, I was like, "Oh, I just painted my front door purple, you know," or, you know, he's like, "Now, do you live on this street or this street?" And I'm like, "Oh, I live on this street." So, you know, I, you know, he seemed harmless and he was a crossing guard and this was just chatting and he had a general idea of where he lived and I had a general idea of where he lived. And I didn't really think anything of it. Maybe I'm naive and maybe I should have, but I didn't. And then one day I dropped my daughter off at kindergarten. I came home. I put my son down for a nap. He miraculously actually started napping, which was really unlike him. My doorbell rang and I answered the door and there was the crossing guard. And I was like, "Hi." He was like, "Hi, I've been thinking about you a lot. Can we chat?" And I was like, "Okay." So I let him into my home. And we had a little conversation and, you know, it wasn't very long and it wasn't very anything. It was just, "Okay, little conversation. This is weird, but you're clearly a lonely guy. Your kids don't come around. Your grandkids don't come around because they're busy." And again, I was like, "Well, this is how I would want someone to treat my grandpa. So sure, let's have a conversation." And then, you know, the conversation ended and we got up to go to the door and I, you know, I walked him to the front door and all of a sudden he turned around and he had pinned me against the wall and he was groping me and he was trying to kiss me. And, it was extremely reminiscent of what happened with my cousin actually. And I was trying to push him off and he got what he wanted and left. And I just kind of was in my house just shaking. I was like, my first thought was, what just happened? And my second thought was, how did I let that happen again? How did I do that again? I have taken self-defense classes. I do push-ups every day. You go in Young Women's and they talk about decide what you're going to do before it happens to you so that you're ready. And I had done that and it didn't work. And how did I let this happen again? How did I do that? I still don't understand. You know, and my kid's in half-day kindergarten, and the next thing I knew, it was time to go across the street. And this guy was there again, and I was just panicked walking the half mile, and finally I was like, I am going to say something to him. I have never done this before. I am going to say something to him and tell him that I didn't like that. So I got there, and he stopped traffic, and we were crossing the street, and he smiled, and he said, how are you? And I said, what you did at my home was inappropriate. Which is really a massive understatement, but that's what I said. And he said, you didn't like it? And I said, no, I didn't like it. Don't ever do that again. And I went and I got my kid and I came back to the, you know, I had my son in the stroller and I had my daughter. We came back and I was crossing the street again. And he said, so are we okay? And I said, no, we're not. And I was very proud of myself. And, I was like, okay, I handled that. That was the end of that. I don't need to deal with that again. But then he, you know, he reached out to me again. He actually had my phone number. And I'm sure that there are self-defense people who will be like, well, that was stupid and whatever. Fine. Maybe it was stupid. Maybe it was friendly and neighborly. It doesn't matter. What matters is that I said, no, we're not okay. And no, that was not okay what you did, and this relationship is not okay. And he called me. And I didn't answer the phone because caller ID is a beautiful thing. And I had my husband call him back and say, don't ever call her again. And I was like, okay, there, it's been taken care of. And then I just looked at my daughter. My kids had no idea what happened. Neither of them were there. Neither of them had been there for any kind of conversation about it. To this day, I don't think either of my kids have any idea. But I looked at my daughter and I thought, okay, if this happens to her, I want her to be brave. And the only way I know of to teach my daughter how to be brave is to do it myself. So 2 days after it happened, I called the police. And I fully expected that they would be like, well, you're fine, you're not bruised, everything's okay, and it's been 2 days, and you know, but the police were awesome. The police were amazing. They're like, we are gonna send an officer over to your home if that's okay with you, and do this face to face. And I was like, okay. I went and explained to my little girl that someone had touched me in a way that was wrong and that I didn't like. And I was telling the police. And so a police car was going to come to our house. But we weren't in trouble. And I wanted her to stay in the family room and watch a movie. But she was probably going to hear me cry. The policeman wasn't hurting me. I was just really upset by something someone else had done. And the policeman was here to help me. And she was like, okay. So the officer came over. And I told him what happened, and he believed me, and he told me that legally it was forcible sexual abuse. It wasn't no big deal. It was a big deal. Then he asked me, you know, what I wanted to do, and I said I just wanted it to go away. I just didn't want it to be a thing anymore. And he said, so are you saying that you don't want to press charges? And I said, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't want to press charges. I just want this to be gone. And he said, okay. Is there anything else that you want? And I said, yeah. Could you reassign that crossing guard. I don't think that the kids are in any danger. I don't think that, you know, someone is bound to be like, I can't believe you let him continue to work with children. I don't care. I did the best that I could. And I just, you know, I said, can you reassign him? And he said, yeah, because I don't know how it is in other cities, but in my city, the crossing guards are actually employees of the police department. And so that man was instantly reassigned. We got a new crossing guard. I've never seen him again. He might be dead. He never called me again. Actually, the police officer went to him and said, you can never call her again. You have to let this go. The officer had told me that's what he was going to say. And I said, okay, yeah, I'm confident with that. So the officer left, and I was still very, very upset. So I called a friend of mine. I was like, do you have a minute to talk? And she's like, let me put my kids down for a nap, and then I'll call you back in about 20 minutes. So she called me back, and I told her what happened. And her response was very interesting. It was very good for me. I can't say that it would be right for everybody, but you know, she's been my friend since I was 5. And so a quarter century of friendship, I tell her the story, and she started to laugh. And she goes, what was he thinking? What in his mind made him think that that was an okay thing to do? And it kind of broke the tension. It was not everything that I needed, but it was a great way to hear that I was not the crazy person. And so we finished that conversation, and I hung up, and I still was really, like, this whole time, there was one particular person that I had wanted to call. And it was the same person that I told about what happened in nursery. And I felt, I really wanted to call them. Like, my heart wanted to call them, and my brain kept saying, no, she's going to ask you what you did to make him think you wanted it. And, you know, I was like, that's ridiculous. This was not my fault.
Talking about the family member that you had, that you had talked to at first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, this is ridiculous. She's not going to say that. This was not my fault. This was a really bad choice on his part. So I called them, and I told this family member what had happened, and I was crying and I was upset. And the first thing she said was, what did you do to make him think that you wanted it? And I said, I got very upset. I said, nothing. I didn't do anything. He made the mistake. And she said, yes, he was wrong. But what did you do to make him think that that would be okay? And I just hung up. I was done with that. And then interestingly, a few weeks later, in Relief Society, the lesson was about always taking the time to serve people no matter what. Even if you think you're busy, even if you think you don't like this person, always take the time. And I raised my hand and I said, you know what? Sometimes it's okay not to. And sometimes, like, if interestingly, the police officer came to my house. He was also LDS, and he'd said, look, I know that women in our church are told to always be kind. I think it would be a good idea if you stopped listening to that and just gave yourself space to not want to serve someone. Because people who want to do these things to women might take advantage of that. You know, and I had been thinking about that for a few weeks, and I decided the officer was right. It was okay for me to not think about others all the time. And it was okay for me to stop and say, what is my gut telling me here? So I had shared this in this Relief Society lesson. And I had mentioned that I had recently been sexually assaulted. And that, you know, I'd shared that it was an older man, and I was just trying to be friendly to someone's grandpa. And I was like, I think it's great to have a service-oriented mindset. But in my life, right now, I am spending less time on serving others and more time listening to myself in case I'm getting a prompting that says, don't serve this person. And the teacher said, no, that is wrong. There is never an excuse not to serve. There is never a reason not to say hello to the lonely old man. You are wrong. And I was astounded. And I didn't say anything else. And I haven't really told anybody about it since. I did have one other sister come up to me afterwards and be like, I am so sorry that happened to you. And it happened to me once. And the teacher was wrong. It's okay to set limits. But that was a discussion that happened in a very private space. The official church discussion was that I was wrong. And there is never a reason not to reach out to someone. And I wholeheartedly disagree with that. So those are the times that I have been assaulted.
Wow, Chelsea, I mean, thank you so much for sharing all of that. That's very, very personal information and so useful to hear you, you know, kind of think through these issues that are so, so dramatic, you know, in our lives and have so many different implications. Sounds like for the first time in your life, you were finally, given the appropriate adult response through the police and even through this friend of yours that put the blame and took your complaint seriously and put the blame, you know, completely on the perpetrator and responded appropriately. It also sounds like you come from a family culture that for some reason isn't good at doing that. And also you're bringing up some church cultural issues that at times we're not good at doing that. I know that you and I kind of connected through some of the responses and internet discussions on Ted Callister's talk on some of these issues. And I had spoken about one of my critiques was that this falls under rape culture. And a lot of people took real issue with my using those terms when it came to obviously a general authority who I'm guessing most of us would assume has really good intentions, right? And would never want to rape somebody or would think that rape was okay. But it's these kinds of issues that you're speaking to. It's that are part of rape culture and the importance of us understanding what rape culture is. That at whatever level, even if it's 1% blame on the victim, that is inappropriate.
So I don't have a subscription to the Ensign. I don't read it. I have not been to church in almost 4 months because I've started having flashbacks at church. So I'm not overly plugged in to the culture. But then I saw on Facebook, like, so many people were upset about this talk. And so I read it. And I'm sure that he has great intentions. But I felt very strongly that your use of the term rape culture was absolutely appropriate. The idea that how I dress is an invitation to you. I get the concept. I do. I get the concept. Like you know, it's just a fact of life. If you dress in a, I don't know, like just you can make assumptions about people based on what they dress, and they are often reasonably accurate. That said, sexual violence is never okay. I don't care what she was wearing. I don't care if she was wearing nothing. I don't care if she was walking around in a thong and pasties and carrying a banner that says, "Ooh, yes, please." Sexual violence is always wrong. It is never the victim's fault ever. And, you know, in case there are guys listening who've been raped, you know, it's not that it's always the guy's fault. It's always the perpetrator's fault. It's never the victim's fault, regardless of what they're wearing. You know, it really struck a nerve with what I'm doing with my own daughter. You know, our backyard we're backyard neighbors with someone. We have a chain link fence, and she was going out to play, and she's like, "Oh, wait, I need to change." And I was like, you know, this was over the summer. It was July. I'm like, "Why?" And she goes, "Oh, well, their dad won't let them play with me if I'm not dressed temple modest." And I was like, "Excuse me?" And she repeated it. And I was like, "All right, listen, this is your backyard. Nobody gets to tell you what to wear." I was furious. My daughter, kids have come up to her on the playground and been like, "That's not modest." And they're getting it from their mothers. And it's not to say that their mothers are bad people. I like these women, but the idea that we are judging each other, you know, what my daughter was wearing was not immodest. It was completely fine. It was not garment ready, but my daughter is 8. Actually, she was not even, yeah, I guess she was 8. No, she wasn't even 8 when that happened. She was wearing this little sundress. It came past her knees. It had a halter top, and the strap on the top was about 1.25 inches thick. It was very cute. It was very age appropriate. And the idea that people are teaching their children to come up to her on the playground at school and be like, "That's not temple modest." Well, who cares? She's not going to the temple, right? So modesty is a big issue for me. I think in part because every single time I have been assaulted, I was wearing something absolutely modest. I think that the emphasis on modesty is misdirecting in a very, very, very hurtful way. I understand why people are doing it. I understand why Elder Callister thinks it's an important topic. And just me projecting onto him, what I'm imagining is that he sees rape as a horrible, horrible, violent thing that is destructive to the victim on so many levels. And it's terrifying. It is terrifying to look at your sister or your wife or your son or your daughter or your uncle or somebody that you love and think, "I am going to let you go out into a world that might do this to you. And there is nothing that I can do to protect you." And I think the rhetoric of modesty imposes a false sense of control. "Well, this bad thing happened to her, but it won't happen to you because you're wearing the right clothes." No, no, that's not true. It didn't happen to her because of what she was wearing. And it's not going to not happen to you because of what you are or not wearing. It's not going to stop until we start saying, "This is never okay." And we're going to listen to every person who says this. And we're not going to blame the victim. So that's kind of my issue with the modesty of rhetoric. And the idea that you get the kind of man that you dress for, it doesn't make sense. I was 3 years old, 3.5. I was wearing white panties with pink hearts on them. And I was wearing my favorite purple shirt. And I was wearing my favorite purple skirt. My skirt went below my knees. My shirt was long sleeved. I was, you know, I had this adorable little preppy vibe going on. And the kind of man that I got had been grooming me for months to trust him. He had been paying attention to what was going on in my family to increase the odds that they were just going to be too stressed out to deal with this. He was so much older than me. I didn't want that at all. I did not dress for the kind of man that I got.
Yes.
And it's just wrong. It's just wrong to say that you have any control over that. I also have a huge issue with the quote. What is it? Better dead than defiled.
Yes, we don't hear that as often now, but I remember hearing that I was in Young Women's.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. We're probably about the same age. That was the big thing in Young Women's. Better dead than defiled. And every time I've heard someone say that, I just want to think, okay, look me in the eyes. Look me in the eyes and tell me that you think it would be better if I was dead. Do you really believe that? Because the women who are getting hurt are not other women. They're not the women who aren't in church. They're not the women who are doing drugs or walking around in lingerie and passing it off as a top or whatever. They're not other. They're us. So if you're going to say that, be willing to look every single person in the room in the eye and believe that it would be better for them to be dead. And then if you're going to say that, I've spent enough of my life wishing that I was dead. I have spent enough of my life actually trying to be dead. I've sent my kids into the backyard and gone into my bedroom and called a suicide hotline, who, by the way, are the most calming people I've ever met. If you're thinking of calling them, you totally should. I have wanted to be dead because of what happened to me. But at the same time, at church, I'm taught that suicide is not an option. Suicide is incredibly ungrateful and just no, you can't do that. Suicide is not an option. Well, where does that leave me? I'm not allowed to kill myself. I wasn't big enough to fight back. So am I garbage to you? Am I nothing to you? Do I not matter? Like, how can you come back from that? How can you come back from, I've been raped and he didn't have the decency to kill me? And I didn't have the guts or lack of, I don't know, understand. I don't know. My therapist keeps saying that really it would be a bad thing if I killed myself. And I have promised to believe him. But he didn't kill me and I didn't kill me and I've been defiled. So where does that leave me with this group? It's not that I wanted it. It's not that I didn't want to fight back. It's not that I didn't tell someone. It's that every single time, the guy has been bigger than me. I'm a small person. If I wanted to, I could go into Limited 2 and buy a pair of pants and they would fit. I am a small person. I am never going to be in a relationship with a guy, platonic or otherwise, where he is smaller than me, unless he's a child. What does this group want from me?
Well, and I think what you're getting at is that we unfortunately, and I'm hoping unintentionally, put so much of the definition of our worth on this idea of sexual purity and how that tends to be defined for lots of different people. And I understand there'll be plenty of people listening that may not understand your logic as far as how you're coming to these assumptions that, you know, you'd be better off dead than defiled and, you know, why you would jump to these conclusions. But I just want to say that it's there. Our history is there to give these types of messages. And for those who have been traumatized in the ways that you're describing, this is a very common path to go down. This is not by any means of the imagination the first time I'm hearing this type of logic around these, you know, messages that we've received as members of our church for those who've been sexually traumatized. So I want to completely validate, you know, where you're coming from on these lines of thinking. And, you know, back to your thoughts about modesty that you spoke so well on, and even this idea of defilement, again, it's like, you know, something that is out of my control, or something that even is somewhat in my control, like how I dress, but then what's out of my control is how people interpret how I dress. So these things that are out of my control somehow end up defining me, and how harmful that is for really all of us, even those who haven't been assaulted per se, you know, that these outward things become definitive of who we are and how we identify with ourselves.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus saved.